Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Today we're going to talk about two significant U.S. campus divestment victories that were hard won by students and community activists in San Francisco, California, and in the Boston area in Massachusetts. On April 19th, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Graduate Student Union democratically adopted a resolution calling for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza and for the MIT community to cut all research and financial ties with the Israeli military. According to the MIT Coalition for Palestine, along with BDS Boston, the Industrial Liaison Program, ILP, of MIT officially cut its ties with Israeli weapons manufacturer Elbit Systems. After a sustained six-month campaign against the program, which included disrupting ILP conferences both in the U.S. and abroad, the coalition says that it sets the stage for future wins against Elbit and the Israeli military complex in the U.S. and around the world. And in California, the University of San Francisco announced plans to divest from four U.S. weapons companies that contract with the Israeli military. According to KQED News, quote, the school's endowment fund will sell off its direct investments in Palantir, L3Harris, GE Aerospace, and RTX Corporation by June 1st, the university confirmed. The four companies, which provide weapons technologies and military intelligence tools to Israel, had been specifically targeted by student activists. Joining us to talk about these campus victories are three guests, Richard Solomon, Liza Berendt, and Ani Delira Lopez. Richard is an MIT doctoral student in political science and a member of the MIT Coalition for Palestine. Liza is a member of BDS Boston, and Ani is a third-year history and teaching student at the University of San Francisco. Welcome, all three of you, to the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you, Nora.
Thanks for being here. Richard and Liza, let's start with you. What can you tell us about the campaign on campus targeting Elbit and this successful divestment? You know, and this comes on the heels of the administration, of course, trying to repress student activism, suspending students. We spoke to MIT grad student Prahlad Iyengar in January of this year, who was banned from campus and expelled for challenging Lockheed Martin's recruitment on campus. Can you tell us about the work that the MIT Coalition for Palestine has been involved in since then, and really how significant this victory against Elbit is?
Yes, well, first of all, thank you for inviting us on. The MIT Coalition for Palestine is about 20 student groups, student and faculty, who have been calling on MIT since October of 2023 to end its ties with Israeli military and with arms providers to the Israeli military. The campaign against Elbit in the ILP started last year in the fall. It follows the successful campaign by BDS Boston to remove Elbit from their office in Cambridge. We began protesting, picketing in coordination with BDS Boston over last fall. And then in December, we released our MIT Science for Genocide research primer, which Electronic Intifada has reported on. This also mentioned Elbit's ties with MIT. These go back several years. We can trace at least since 2017. They have an engagement with this industrial liaison program, which gives companies with high revenue values privileged access to campus, gives them an opportunity to collaborate with researchers here, monitor research developments, recruit staff and MIT graduates into the armed company. We saw this as immoral, as against the spirit of the institution, at least among us, as kind of responsible scientists. It also goes against the democratic will of the student body, which was expressed through a series of referenda on this exact issue. starting last spring. And so this is very much a culmination of that campaign. We first heard that they were removed from this program at the beginning in January or so, but it took a few months to confirm this. We wanted to be sure. In the words of Amilcar Cabral, we tell no lies, we claim no easy victories. So we did not want to be too hasty about it, but we became more and more confident about this. We heard it from multiple sources, in writing from the program director. We noticed that they are no longer listed among the companies to when you register for IOP conferences, which happen across the globe. And we're very proud and thankful for our colleagues, particularly in East Asia, in Tokyo, in Seoul, South Korea, and in Bangkok, who also protested the IOP there. And so as much as this is a win for the students, it's also a win for the Boston-wide community, and Lisa can speak more about that, as well as the entire global divestment campaigns. And so we're really happy that MIT, as this premier institution, is finally conceding, not by its own will, but by the will of the student movements and by the moral community around us.
Incredible. Yeah, Lisa, if you want to add into that and talk about how the community, you know, those of you who are not students on campus at MIT, really rallied in support and what that looked like in material ways to successfully pressure this enormous institution, you know, a very, you know, one of the most predominant scientific centers, research centers in the world, to cut ties with this Israeli company. What did that campaign look like?
Yeah, thank you. BDS Boston is one of many Palestine Solidarity community organizations in Boston, and we have really organized our strategies around where we can most, where we can have the biggest impact in cutting off direct complicity of the local community in Israeli genocide. Elbit is a company that really stood out both because of its particularly egregious role in violence and genocide, and because of how important Elbit's leaders see Cambridge and the surrounding Boston community, as how important they see that as part of their global strategy. Elbit is Israel's largest weapons dealer. They manufacture 85% of Israel's military drones. Elbit describes its drones as the backbone of the Israeli Defense Forces. And in addition, it supplies the Israeli military with tanks, munitions, surveillance towers, and being the largest weapons company that is based in Israel, it also plays a really key role in Israel's economy and the economy of the nation state as a whole that is continuing to inflict genocide. We saw them as a really key target, also because of the role that they play in global violence. They test these new weapons out on Palestinians, on this imprisoned population in Gaza, and then they sell those battle-proven weapons to oppressive regimes all over the world. They're active on the U.S.-Mexico border. They work with the Philippines. Local Filipino activists have been really active in trying to fight them in the Boston area. We see a strike to Elbit's power as a strike to Israel and to the global global military industrial complex. Then, as for Cambridge, Elbit saw it as very important to their strategy to be in Cambridge, to have access to Harvard and MIT researchers, scientists, thought leaders. And when they opened their Cambridge Innovation Center in Central Square, they made it a press event. They were very proud of getting to be in proximity to these global thought and scientific leaders. So we felt it would be particularly a blow to them if we were able to kick them out of Cambridge. So that's why in 2023, in March 2023 was when BDS Boston joined the global fight against Elbit and, as Richard mentioned, led a successful campaign to force them out of their offices at 130 Bishop Allen Drive in Central Square. So when they did in fact vacate that office in August of 2024, our next move was, where else can we push back on Elbit's influence locally and end this complicity locally? And MIT's Industrial Liaisons Program was the most logical next step. And we were really excited to get to partner with MIT students. Additionally, we are coordinating with activists worldwide who are fighting Elbit. So, while we were picketing every week outside of the ILP office, making call-in campaigns to ILP leaders and disrupting ILP conferences in Cambridge, we also had allies disrupting international conferences that ILP held in Seoul, Tokyo, Bangkok. And so we were able to really be part of global pressure on Elbit.
And it's, the campaign sounds like many other campaigns that have happened for years and years and years, demanding that a university cut its ties with, all weapons companies or a targeted weapons company, something specific. And, it's sometimes few and far between that a university, especially one as prestigious as MIT, would actually listen to those demands. So what was it about this campaign where the university decided it wasn't worth the risk to keep Elbit on its contracts? What was it that really was the catalyst for MIT deciding that Elbit was not going to be part of its ILP program?
Well, I would say that, yes, you're right, that the campaign has gone on for a while. Divestment has been on our agenda for a long time. What might be different now is the extreme levels of mobilization from the community and from students in particular. I mean, we don't just, send polite emails. We show up to the office, we picket outside, we make the staff feel uncomfortable. We went to the MIT Museum, which is like a public place tourists go, and we would have rallies there. We had like waves of phone calls to the office. We went there several times. We know that Elbit itself has become a toxic asset globally. I think Barclays Bank divested shares of Elbit. Of course, anytime they do this, whether it's Barclays, whether it's MIT, they will deny it's because of activist pressure. And we know that's just not a very convincing story. But I think it is the genocide in Gaza. It's the global awakening of public opposition to the genocide and to the aiding and abetting of that by the most prestigious and institutions in America. I think that's what's doing it now. And we know from the ILP staff who we talk to, who are not willing to share this publicly, but they will tell us in person, that they're privately deeply ashamed of what's going on. And so this can become in some ways an excuse for them to get rid of an asset that's become toxic, that's no longer great for their image. We also know on Elbit's side, this was not it may have been an MIT decision. It could have also been Elbit's own decision to remove themselves from a community that's extremely hostile towards it. And we would not have got to that point without the levels of mobilization we see now. And so we're excited for the future. As we said, this is only the first. We know that Elbit AI engineers continue to collaborate with MIT faculty on drone coordination projects. Those projects are often sponsored by the Israeli military itself directly. We know this violates MIT's own rules on foreign engagements. It violates the rules of our own conscience, and it disrespects the majority mass opinion of students, faculty, and people of conscience around the world.
Yeah, I would add, like, agree with all of that. I would also add that one lesson BDS Boston has been learning is the importance of persistence, continuing to show up until we not only annoy the targets of our campaigns, but annoy people around them so that folks who are in the general vicinity and might not be persuaded and have their minds changed despite the, the global upswell in support for Palestine, they may still want our targets to listen to us so that they can get some peace. I know in our Central Square campaign to end Elbit's lease, the co-tenants in the building where Elbit was renting became really key players in the campaign because it wasn't just Elbit staff who were intimidated to come into work and cross a picket line and have people talking to them about genocide. It was also other renters in that building, and many of whom reached out to us and said, please stop. I have nothing to do with this. Why are you bothering me? And our response was, don't talk to us, talk to your landlord and tell him to do something about this. And it got to the point where, regardless of the political sympathies of the landlord, it became untenable for him to continue making a profit off of that building as long as these disruptive pickets continued to happen. Our big takeaway from that as BDS Boston was to remain persistent, even if we can't change people's minds and people's hearts, we can have them encourage them to act in their self-interest to not be associated with genocide profiteers.
Yeah, there's so many ways to get involved and remain involved. Ani, let's bring you into this. Tell us about the divestment win at the University of San Francisco and what led up to the administration formally agreeing to cut ties with not one, but four weapons manufacturers that contract with the Israeli military.
Yeah, so I actually recently just got an email like a couple minutes ago. The university actually made its public announcement regarding the divestment, which there's a lot to unpack there. Essentially, I think it's important to note that the university said that they wouldn't individually invest in those companies, but that they will not make any effort to change or to disclose the like commingled investments that they have, which means that they could still absolutely be invested in those four companies, but within those like commingled investment, I don't know. I'm not super knowledgeable on like the terminology, but I do know that that means that they could still be invested in those companies just through other ways. But obviously the divestment from the companies as individuals is still a huge win, especially because we know that it is absolutely because of the persistent, non-stopping campaign by students, especially USF undergrad students, to get the university to, one, disclose, because that was already a fight in and of itself, because the university is a private institution, and so the investments are not in any way like publicly disclosed. And so that was kind of the main goal of the encampment that happened a year ago. And then after, we got some disclosure through the Divestment Task Force, which was a student and administration kind of coalition of people that were working to research on what companies the university was invested in and how those might be unethical and problematic, specifically regarding the Israeli genocide in Palestine. So yeah, the divestment was a huge win. It came at the same time as a student-led occupation of a room in the library at our university. And I think it was really, really inspiring to see that it was just a small group of students that could kind of lead to such a huge change and a huge pressure on the university. Obviously, as other folks on this podcast were saying, they're never going to like admit that it was because of the students. They're never going to say, oh, we're bowing down to the student demands. They're going to say, you know, it just so happened to coincidentally occur at the same time as the occupation occurred. And so we know a lot of us organizers and community members and people of conscience know and see past that and know that it's absolutely because of the year-long protest, rallies, flyering campaigns, emailing campaigns, occupations and sit-ins and teach-ins and so many different tactics that the students have taken to get the university to divest. It's because of all of those things, and there's no doubt about that. I think that similar to MIT, we've been organizing specifically for divestment since October of 2023, specifically about the Israeli genocide of Palestine. But prior to that, there was some other like folks on campus who were kind of organizing for a more like socially responsible divestment policy and investment policy. But it was really after October of 2023 that things really ramped up on campus, because everybody was really becoming more aware of the genocide in Palestine, and it was a really a call to mobilization that Gaza was putting out to the world, and the students specifically, I know in the Bay Area, really responded to that. So after October of 2023, there was an increase in rallies, an increase in protests and student demonstrations on campus to get the university to, one, declare that what was happening in Palestine was a genocide, because they still to this day refuse to call it that. And that is something that the students have kind of called out their hypocrisy on so much, because of the fact that our university is a Jesuit institution. It's a institution that prides itself on being a socially just and like socially aware hub for students all around the world to come. And, you know, their slogan is change the world from here, make the world a better place from here. And so we always, you know, try to claim that, you know, USF is such a hot spot for this activism and for this like ethical programs when it comes to our like agriculture programs, environmental studies, and all those things. And so there's a huge like contradiction there with supporting a genocide, supporting an ecocide happening in Palestine right now. So we were able to kind of educate other students on, hey, you know, this school markets itself as being somewhere where you can come and change the world. Did you know that we are actively investing in genocide? So that is some messaging that I think has been extremely powerful. And I'm really proud of other students who have been able to get that messaging out there to local media, to other people in the Bay Area. And I think because we're a Jesuit private institution, we're kind of in this very unique place where we're able to, I don't like to use the word capitalize, because that feels very icky to say, but we're able to benefit off of their own messaging, the marketing that they chose to give to students in order to get them to pay $90,000 to go there. So I think that the students have done a great job of using that and turning it around and shoving it in their faces and saying, hey, you guys are saying, you know, this is your purpose, and then you're doing the exact opposite of that. So what I will say in terms of like continuity in the last year and a half, in terms of organizing for Palestine, there have been so many efforts from the administration to oppress and repress all student speech. Obviously, our university had more than 25 students get suspended after the encampment, and we were very privileged to not have had SFPD called on us, I think, again, because of us being a private institution and the image that USF wants to continue to have as a, you know, safe place for social justice activists, whatever that means to them. So I think since then, there have been changes to the student code of conduct, actually, that made it extremely hard for us to organize. SJP is totally banned from our campus. So we have a cultural organization instead that kind of on the back end does the organizing, but on the front end is just a cultural celebration for Palestine, but aren't allowed to engage in any sort of political activity because it's deemed as being anti-Semitic. So, but I think the students have done a great job of working around that, working within those limitations in terms of with the school and with the faculty. But obviously, especially this spring, there's become a moment of like urgency and escalation. And a lot of the students, myself included, recognized that it's been far too long since we escalated. It's been far too long since we put our bodies on the line for Palestine and for Gaza, especially after the World Food Program announced that it was running out of food and, you know, no aid has been allowed in for more than 2 months. And so I think a lot of the students looked at each other and were like, yes, the repression is so scary. Yes, the suspensions were a horrible thing to go through and people are dying and children are starving. So we have to act now. We have to escalate now. And obviously we had to do a lot of risk assessment on our end and think about who has citizenship, who has like student visas and like immigration status and like all those things were considered so that, you know, we weren't putting ourselves in unnecessary risk or putting the entire movement on campus in unnecessary like danger, because obviously if all of us got arrested that were part of the movement, that doesn't help anybody. That really stifles the entire history of work that we've done on campus. And so we had to really be careful and very intentional about who was engaging in these escalations and how what we could do to protect their anonymity and their status as students at the university. But overall, I'm really, really proud of the win that we had, despite the university claiming it had nothing to do with our protest, nothing to do with our occupation. We know. And ultimately, I think we are showing the rest of the student population and USF alumni and community how much power we hold as students. And I think that is the most powerful message of all. That is kind of the takeaway from this win.
And Ani, of course, you know, it's not like the student movement is now just going to, you know, go back and rest and not remain committed and organized, probably even more so after this kind of divestment victory. Can you talk about what it means to organize now at this point? You know, you've gotten divestment demands have been, you know, somewhat met. How do you sustain that momentum? And what does that look like right now at USF?
I think I want to highlight that there were three demands that we had at the Hassam Shabbat atrium occupation, one of which was divestment. One was ending academic ties with the Israeli occupation and the normalization of the displacement and stolen land of Palestinian people, specifically through this study abroad program that they have with Israel that takes students from USF to occupied land in Palestine and teaches them about conflict and conflict resolution and, you know, the joys of living amongst different kinds of people and how beautiful that can look. And of course, extremely problematic in normalizing genocide, normalizing ethnic cleansing. So that was our second demand. Our third demand was getting the university to declare itself a sanctuary campus for all students, including immigrant and refugee students, including students with Palestinian background and who have been large advocates for Palestine. And so I think some next steps really include pressuring the university to end that program, because it's such a like tangible thing that we can end. It's one program. It's one single like aspect of the university that we have time and time again targeted as a normalization of the occupation. And so that's one thing that's on our agenda, as well as the Sanctuary Campus Declaration. And I know, especially for me as somebody who grew up with an undocumented parent, like the marketing of USF as somewhere that has been so forward-thinking when it comes to immigration, that was something that really reassured me when I came there. And I was like, I will be around other people who have that similar experience, whether it's being undocumented themselves or coming from undocumented families. That gave me a lot of reassurance and made me feel like I was safe. And then for the university to kind of take a step back amidst the Trump administration's attacks on undocumented people and say, you know, that's a little bit political for us. You know, we're more of a, that's not really in our range of issues that we want to talk about. That's been really shameful and really disappointing to see. So I think moving forward, we're going to continue to pressure the university and using similar tactics and different tactics that we have in the past, whatever that might look like. But I think after the occupation of the Hissam Shabbat atrium, we, like so many people, have been made aware, like 5 students did that, you know? And I think we got so intimidated by seeing what went down at UCLA and Columbia and Stanford, where we're like, wow, dozens of students, hundreds of students are getting repressed, are getting brutally assaulted by the police, by law enforcement. How can 5 students do anything? How can 5 students take a stand and make meaningful change? But I think once we considered where we were at in the grand scheme of things as a private institution, as a Jesuit institution, as a smaller school in general, I think a lot of the student population has kind of been awakened to the fact that we have so much more power than we think as individual students. And so I'm really hopeful going forward that we'll be able to get the university to declare itself a sanctuary campus, to end that horrible program that normalizes occupation, as well as in general, I think getting the university to like to say what's going on in Palestine is a genocide, especially the fact that our presidents have always been Jesuit priests or Jesuit leaders. And so that's also something that I think, especially after the passing of Pope Francis, and I don't know if you guys saw Pope Leo making a statement yesterday about ending or calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Those are all things that I think we can keep in mind and use as pressure points for the university to say, look, you guys are saying this has nothing to do with religion, it has nothing to do with theology. What do you say to the Pope, who is your self-declared leader, who is your, you know, guiding star, North Star, and when he's calling for a ceasefire, what do you say to that? How do you justify continuing to support a genocide? So yeah, those are our kind of next steps that we're looking towards. I'm excited to continue to engage lower classmen. I think that has been something really exciting for me as an upperclassman to see freshmen and sophomores get involved, and even high schoolers that come from the community and support. It's like really beautiful to see.
Thank you so much for that, Ani. And Richard, what can you say about similar, you know, sustained organizing at MIT? Does what's happening at USF kind of resonate with you in Boston?
Well, it certainly invigorates us, and I appreciate Ani's perspective on how that decision unfolded. For us, we will continue to call on MIT to end its ties with Israeli military. For those who don't know, the Israeli Ministry of Defense directly sponsors research at MIT in laboratories and computer science and AI, in mechanical engineering and so on. These projects have fairly obvious military applications. They will call it basic research, you know, open source, not classified and so on. But the reality is that only certain kinds of companies and economic formations have the ability and the interest in profiting off of a new coordination algorithm for drones, for instance. And so we continue to call on MIT to immediately end its ties with that, and for MIT faculty in these labs in particular to cut off ties and to seek transitional funding. This is something MIT has done in the past with students, students and researchers affected by their departure from Russia following the invasion of Ukraine. MIT ended its ties with the Saudi oil giant Aramco following the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. We've seen them do this before, and we know they can do it again. In fact, their own policies require that. This is a bit in the weeds, but they say, for instance, that any projects happening in Saudi Arabia have to be vetted to ensure that they do not indirectly or directly legitimize violations of human rights. That's a standard they could apply equally well to the occupation in Palestine, to the genocide in Gaza. So that remains a point. We also know that MIT has a direct engagement with Maersk. It's a global shipping and logistics company that's transported, I think, at least a few hundred thousand tons of military cargo to Israel during the genocide. These are weapons that are actively used in Gaza, and MIT maintains this relationship with them through the Center of Transportation and Logistics. So all these things will continue. MIT is the kind of place where it can be somewhat overwhelming to do this work. MIT's relationship with the defense complex is well understood by many people. Noam Chomsky talked about this in the 60s and 70s. There was a mass movement about that then, and there's a mass movement now. And despite their repression, their attacks on free speech, their shutting down of the opinion section in the newspaper, for instance, the suspension and banning of dozens of students on the basis of their activism, we will continue, and we do not plan to stop. And this win with Elbit is only invigorates us towards, I think, a better future. You know, we as students, as much as we critique our institutions, we do love science and research. I mean, people are here because they're nerds. Like Prahlad, who you spoke with a few months ago, studied quantum information theory. Like, can you imagine? These people are so brilliant and bright. And I have so much love and excitement for what this generation is going to bring as they graduate and go out. And as we continue to take in more high schoolers who are fired up and who did not grow up and come into political consciousness at a time when Zionism was acceptable. So it's only looking worse and worse for the merchants of death. And we know we're on the right side of history. That's what I'd say.
That's beautiful. Ani, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I totally forgot to add in terms of next steps forward. It's a little off topic from what Richard was sharing, but I wanted to add that another thing we're focusing on moving forward is the both physical and like emotional protection of students on campus, specifically after the Hissam Shabbat atrium, because I don't know how many people know about this, and this is something we're trying to share more with media moving forward, but one of the students at the Hissam Shabbat atrium was actually physically assaulted by another student, a Zionist student, who basically broke through into the atrium and then punched them in the chest and shoved them into a metal door and left them with pretty severe bruising to the point where they had to go to the hospital. So not a lot of people are talking about this because I think everybody kind of got like, whoa, divestment, that's all we're thinking about. But the university actually has done nothing to support that student who was assaulted. And even though they've had the full identification of the student who committed the assault, is refusing to do anything until the student who was assaulted comes forward with their name. And obviously that will result in disciplinary consequences because the student wasn't supposed to be protesting in that way to begin with. So the university called SFPD on 5 peaceful protesters, but has done everything to support a full-fledged abuser and somebody who's assaulted another student. So moving forward, that is also something we're trying to get the university to own up to and to hold them accountable And to honestly get that student removed from campus because they are a huge physical threat. They have made so many physical threats and like literal death threats to our pro-Palestine orgs on campus and students on campus. So that is just something I wanted to add and highlight because I don't want to allow for the divestment win to take away from the very real harm that was caused and from the fact that that student is still being supported and funded by the university. So just wanted to add that. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that. And Lisa, maybe that's a good segue for you to kind of talk about what this movement looks like and in terms of kind of a macro view. You've been involved in Palestine solidarity organizing for a long time, specific to Boston, but kind of, you know, countrywide as well. And as students are kind of forging this path, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants from decades past, from movements past, and are you know, not just organizing themselves, doing these kinds of encampments. There's hunger strikes happening now across the country at Stanford, UCLA, I think Cal State Long Beach, Yale. As they're doing that, but they're also trying to kind of hold each other in this emotional, you know, state of shock and grief and rage at what we're all seeing streamed to our phones 24/7 from the ground in Gaza. Like, what is your kind of overview of where the movement is at? And how do you see it going forward right now?
Yeah, thank you. Hard to say exactly where the movement is at, but from my perspective as someone who started as a student activist 16 years ago, I can definitely share how encouraged I am by the groundswell of support that is happening, like not just on campuses, but in so many different sectors, and specifically how many people are joining and forming organizations to like strategically apply pressure in their respective areas. You know, people, when I see how specific the Palestine solidarity organizations are, you know, in Boston, there's neighborhood groups for Palestine all over the city and the broader region. I have a friend who's organizing a group called Scream Fans for Palestine. There's Birders for Palestine. And what is really encouraging to me is that people getting riled up in solidarity with Palestinians are not just posting on social media. They're going to where they work, live, congregate, and figuring out where are the areas of complicity and how do we strategically target that. Let's keep chipping away. And one thing I wanted to add to what Richard shared about next steps in at MIT and in the Boston area is I wanted to emphasize MERSC that Richard mentioned is being targeted by a international campaign led by Palestinian youth movement, Mask Off MERSC. So at BDS Boston, we right now are still waiting to announce our next campaign, but we know we will be supporting the Mask Off MERSC campaign at MIT. And just want to shout out like how important Palestinian youth movements leadership in Boston has been on this campaign that we're talking about today against Elbit, and in like building the broader citywide movement.
Thanks so much for that. Yeah, the Mask Off MERSC campaign has been extraordinary. We've done a few interviews now with some of those organizers at PYM, and it's yeah, I mean, this coalition keeps building, this movement keeps building, I'm thrilled to see what happens next, what comes next. It's a bright spot in a very, very dark time these days. So I want to thank all three of you, Lisa Barrent from BDS Boston, Richard Solomon at MIT, and Ani De Lira Lopez at University of San Francisco. Thank you so much, all of you, for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast. And please keep us posted on your campaigns.
Thank you, Nora.
Thank you.